91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today we visit with Johns Hopkins University history professor Nathan Connolly. He's written a book which tells the story of racism and real estate in South Florida before, during, and after the Jim Crow era. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. He tells how Miami's first black beach came to be, how the construction of I-95 impacted a thriving black business and entertainment zone, and how early Miami race relations were impacted by a large percentage of Caribbean-born people of color. He adds that Jim Crow real estate racism not only benefited whites, but black landowners as well. We'll discuss the book, A World More Concrete: Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow. First, a news update. And 7 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Tuesday. Bonnie, I'm sure you're aware that just a few blocks south of here, underneath I-95 and 395, where the guys look for handouts to wash windshields, there's a dark, blighted area under the viaduct there, the ramp to 395 west. Right. Are you aware that in 1969 it was dedicated as a park for kids with swing sets and jungle gyms?
I wasn't until I read this book. I am now.
Well, we'll learn more about that, and we'll learn more South Florida history in regard to race, real estate, and politics from Johns Hopkins University professor Nathan N.D.B. Connolly. He's written A World More Concrete, Real Estate, and the Remaking of Jim Crow, South Florida. Welcome to you, Nathan Connolly.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. Tell us how 20th century Jim Crow practices in South Florida differed from the rest of the country, and why was that?
Miami is both in the Caribbean and in the U.S. South, and it was built largely from investment money coming from northern entrepreneurs. And so part of what became extraordinarily unique in the early goings of Miami's Jim Crow was that it was largely an invention of northern investors, and it was an invention meant to try to control and corral an extraordinarily diverse population of color. At the end of the 19th century, Miami was a region that was relatively remote, considered something of a backwater. The most prominent population of color was Seminole Indians and Bahamian migrants, largely coconut farmers and truck farmers. And in an attempt to build a tourist destination and ultimately an economy on real estate speculation, you had entrepreneurs who were willing to impose various forms of segregation in a way to carve up the landscape and use some of its development to make sure that populations remained segregated, and you had these new economies of leisure and of real estate growth. And so Miami begins right out of the gate at the 20th century at the establishment of the separate but equal order that comes down with Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896. Miami's founding is the same date as Plessy in terms of the year. And it's a city that doesn't claim to have really deep kind of Old South connections to the history of antebellum slavery. So if you're talking about the emergence of Jim Crow, it's not necessarily going to be an argument about Southern tradition. It's much more about political and economic expediency. So right from the beginning, there's a way that Miami's growth is absolutely bound to the origins of Jim Crow.
What brought the Caribbean-born Miami blacks to the area, especially Coconut Grove? Was there something amiss in their homelands?
Well, one could actually make the argument that what made Miami part of America at all, right? There was a way that many Bahamians, they traveled so freely between their own archipelago and the Florida Peninsula that many considered to be simply an extension of where they lived. And there's actually a very interesting development within black and white politics in the Jim Crow moment in 1920, where you begin to see Bahamians making an argument that because most of the population, the black population, is from the Bahamas, that Miami should be considered actually part of the British Empire and not be considered part of the United States. So Miami's own geographic loyalty is far from a settled matter deep into the 1920s. But that being said, there were absolutely farming opportunities. There were employment opportunities that were available. The Bahamas was actually suffering a pretty dramatic squeeze economically. You had a number of Greek aquaculture farmers who had come in and basically monopolized sponge harvesting and other forms of growth coming out of the oceans. Pineapple harvesting became very tightly constrained through new products that were coming out of Hawaii at the early part of the 20th century. And so there were very real driving factors that made the Bahamas as a chain of islands far less attractive to those workers. And many of them came to Miami and bought real estate or had small plots of land that they began to start a new life with.
And how did the Bahamian blacks blend in with the blacks that were already here?
So Coconut Grove, as Joseph already mentioned, was a real hub for many of the Bahamians who were there, and their roots go well back into the early 19th century in terms of that travel, again, between the islands. But there's also a community that develops right after the railroad comes down in the 1890s, and that's Colored Town, right? It's the community that now is considered to be Overtown. During the bulk of my story, it's called the Central Negro District. Mm-hmm. And that community was largely populated by African Americans and Bahamians, and there were a number of moments where you had very serious conflict between American blacks and West Indian blacks, not just Bahamians, but also folks from Jamaica and from Haiti and even parts of Latin America, Cuba and the like. And some of this revolved around, again, what would be Miami's kind of political loyalties? Would it be built as an Old South city? Would Jim Crow order carry the day? And with Jim Crow order, did that in fact mean that whites were able to exact a kind of constant threat of vigilante violence on those black populations? Well, some of the early conflicts between American blacks and West Indian blacks actually revolved around whether or not whites would have a certain amount of control over black populations, which black people would American whites negotiate with. There's a group that's called the Colored Board of Trade, for instance, that emerges as a kind of representative group for American blacks, and they were opposed to a group called the Overseas Club, which was largely British subjects, both white Irish, but also West Indian blacks, who tried to make this argument about Miami really belonging to much more than just the U.S. And so some of the early events include a man by the name of Herbert Brooks, who was accused of sexually assaulting a white woman and was handed over to white authorities by African Americans. And he was eventually put on a train and then thrown from that train. And Brooks's death creates a real conflict in the streets that included gun battles between West Indians and American blacks. It included protests against African-American businesses and boycotts. It included marches in the streets of Colored Town. And in fact, the origins of the group that we now know as the Universal Negro Improvement Association, or the Garvey Organization, that was built around ideas around Pan-Africanism, was created in Miami as a response to heal some of the rifts between the West Indian blacks and the African Americans. And it didn't last terribly long for a whole host of reasons about kind of volatile leadership, but it was very much a kind of constant thread running through the history of Jim Crow that there were both moments of contestation and occasionally moments of collaboration between West Indian and American black folk.
Professor Connolly, in the book, you tell us about how the few black entrepreneur real estate barons, so to speak, including Dana Dorsey, actually contributed to maintaining segregation for their own financial well-being. Expand on that.
So I think it's important to keep in mind that the world that I spend most of my book talking about is a world before Brown versus the Board of Education. There's no sense that segregation is going to end by legal means anytime soon, especially prior to World War II. And so the world that many of these black entrepreneurs are living in is one where they have to navigate the kind of rules and the evolving mores of segregation. So Dana Dorsey is someone who comes down to Miami from southern Georgia, and he is an early worker on Flagler's Railroad outside of Miami. And into the downtown area. He acquires a number of pieces of property, and eventually he becomes a very prominent real estate developer who has properties in Cuba, properties in Louisiana, an oil field actually in Louisiana, copper mines in Colorado, in addition to land across the region. And one of the most fascinating things about Dorsey is that he was someone who demonstrated that capital moved much easier than people did in the Jim Crow moment. And what I mean by that is he owned land that whites actually rented from him and paid him in, you know, consistent fees, you know, every week, sometimes every month, even though African Americans were not allowed through various zoning means to live on those same pieces of property that he owned. And so you have an early black entrepreneurial class that realizes pretty quickly that if Miami's going to grow, it's in the city's interest to sell land as quick as possible to whoever the best buyers are and to collect property taxes on that land. But they're not going to allow the free flow of people in order to, you know, sustain this segregated economy. So Dorsey is able to reach a pretty unique level of affluence in the Jim Crow era by having properties both within the black community that are, you know, dealing with a confined population there, but also on the white side of town with a population that's only interested in living far from African Americans or West Indians. So, yeah, he's a very savvy operator and one of several that I talk about in the book.
When did the threats of violence and actual violence begin over racial real estate boundaries in Miami?
So at the end of the 19-teens, there's a very clear sense that racial zoning is a possibility. There's a major case that's coming out of Baltimore that is meant to see whether or not states have the right to impose strict racial rules on who can live where. And ultimately, the case falls apart in a decision called Buchanan v. Worley in 1917. And the argument there is that you cannot impinge on the property rights of individuals who simply want to sell their property. You can't actually say that there are set aside racial districts. And so that from the early part of the 20th century, there are real concern that racial terrorism is going to be the only thing that keeps the color lines in place. And so you see a number of bombing attacks against black occupied property that in fact is owned by white landlords. You see some black businesses that are attacked in an area called Highland Park, which is just west of the downtown area. And so that begins a set of conversations about how city fathers can try to instantiate the racial peace, try to create a climate of economic growth. And so they try a variety of means that include building a fence and painting one side black with tar to connote the black side and the other side white to connote that side. Then you see the development of concrete walls around developments in the 1930s and 40s. And that becomes a pretty predominant architectural feature across the region for a big part of the 20th century, where if you're going to have any kind of development at all, you need to make sure that these concrete walls are in place. And then there's a bigger program that comes out of the federal level with the Depression and the emergence of these New Deal housing programs. And there again, the idea is that if you use financing and control the mechanisms of mortgages, you can encourage there to be greater racial peace between blacks and whites, and you wouldn't have the kind of violence that wouldn't just mar Miami, but was also affecting cities in Chicago when there was racial transitions or in New York. So the idea that you had to keep racial violence in a bottle became a dominant piece of American housing policy once you got through the 1920s and into the Depression era of the 1930s.
We're speaking to history professor Nathan Connelly. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University, and he's written A World More Concrete, Real Estate, and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. A short break, and we'll return.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Nathan Connelly. We're talking about his book, A World More Concrete, about real estate and the remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we have a lot of great South Florida history to discuss. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, Bonnie will take your email. It's radio@wlrn.org. Nathan Connelly, it's a little difficult to talk about this. I've been in this area working in journalism for over 40 years and knew very well Ethel Lee Range. She's been on this program discussing, I guess, her last big project, which was the restoration of Virginia Key. And in the book, you relate that for all of her landmark political and social progress, including the Miami City Commission and the Florida Legislature, you termed her a slumlord in a sense. Could you explain that?
So I had the opportunity to watch a very important documentary that was made in the early 1970s called Miami Condemned. And I, you know, had a chance to meet Range personally while she was still alive, and I recognized her prominence in the city. And it became obvious when you look at this documentary, and you can actually go to the University of Georgia's archive and pull this up. It's a digital film. The camera crews are walking through her real estate, and one, a particular house occupied by a tenant named Rose Lee Wyatt. And Miss Wyatt is describing some of the conditions that she's living under in terms of holes in the ceiling and broken windows and holes in the floor. And there's a very clear sense that Mrs. Range wasn't terribly diligent in keeping her property up. And there's a actual paper trail that goes back into the 1960s where there are several cases that are brought against her in terms of the conditions of her property. Now, this is important and both ironic for a couple of reasons. The irony, of course, is that Athalie Range, as a member of the city commission, became very instrumental in trying to bring certain absentee landlords to heel and actually institute certain kinds of housing reform during the late part of the 60s and into the 70s. The importance of these practices, though, run far beyond the story of just one prominent black entrepreneur, because when you start to think about the economy of segregation and confined rental populations and begin to poke around some of the records of other prominent civil rights leaders, you realize that property ownership became a fundamental feature of developing black independence and black political voice. And what I mean by that is that if you wanted to take a step out in the open at all and advocate for any kind of equality, especially in the era before Brown versus the Board of Education, you had to have some kind of steady income stream that would prevent whites from being able to lean on you or leverage your, you know, moderate status or modest status as an employee or as, you know, some kind of domestic servant from being able to keep you from pushing for your rights. I mean, Range in particular is a remarkable story because in 1937, she's a domestic herself. She eventually, you know, opens a chain of funeral homes. She eventually opens a black savings and loan. And by the time you get to the 1970s, she's an appointee of President Jimmy Carter. Right. So this is a very uncommon but remarkable ascension from the lowliest position in the Jim Crow economy. Again, a housekeeper, a black housekeeper, to a presidential appointee. And one of the things that I think is important for us to keep in mind is that that kind of ascendancy gets subsidized by black poor folk who are renting in these segregated economies, at least in part. You know, there's a broader story to be told about someone like W.E.B. Du Bois, who in his own autobiography talks about being a slum landlord in Harlem in the 1930s, right? This is a far less known story than the one that we know about the radical intellectual who, you know, lived such a long and important life, or the story of Mary McLeod Bethune, or the Spalding family in North Carolina. I mean, there are a number of ways, and again, the quality of the housing isn't always bad. It's important to emphasize. But there are moments where when blacks are trying to maximize their profit margins, they let their property fall into some disrepair. And so I actually begin the story with just an example of Athalie Range to show the deep contradictions of someone who can clearly be on the side of civil rights for a whole host of reasons, and yet for economic reasons might end up falling into a category that, you know, her own tenant would describe as being a slumlord. So
you say that some African Americans embraced housing segregation. Why was that?
So there are a couple of important things to keep in mind about the way segregation worked. And one of them was that because you had a confined population, African Americans could be exploited relatively easily. The way I think about it for listeners to best understand is, imagine when you take your family to Disney World. And one thing that you tell your kids when you take them to Disney World is that you try not to buy food or souvenirs or other things that are very expensive, because they know that once you walk in those gates, you have very limited options, right? So you can pay $6 or $7 for a side of French fries or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So the Jim Crow economy is like Disney World without the rides, right? It's a place with a confined population where everything costs more for less. And just as one example, you know, you have really deplorable housing that could be, you know, built of wood, a shotgun shack that could cost you $18 a week in, say, 1950. At the very same time, for a hotel room on the white side of town that included beachfront access and probably some kind of electronic amenities within the room, you paid $17.50 a week, or actually 50 cents cheaper than slum property at this time. So many African Americans recognized this kind of exploitation. They pushed, especially in the early part of the 20th century, for something called mutual segregation that, in fact, made sure that white capital couldn't come into these communities and just harvest the rents out and then use those to build other kinds of amenities or institutions or schools on the white side of the color line. There was a very clear argument, again, from members of the Colored Board of Trade and others, who basically said, if you allow us to control our own economy, then we'll make some of the hardships of Jim Crow basically disappear. And of course, that doesn't happen, because in addition to someone like Athalie Range, who might mean well, you have folks like Ebenezer Stirrup, who was a landlord based out of Coconut Grove, who didn't have any real progressive agenda per se, but was really interested in collecting as many rental properties as possible and had his tenants in very difficult living circumstances. And by the time you get to the mid-60s, his properties are collapsing and killing black children, and they're showing up on the front page. And so, you know, it creates, even with these arguments for mutual segregation, a confined population with very few options.
In World War II America and into the 50s, urban redevelopment programs became very popular. I'm from St. Louis, so I got to see the Pruitt-Igoe Bazaar area. But in Miami, they started the Liberty Square and other redevelopment programs. Tell us the history of that and why in the end it failed.
So one thing I think that's important to keep in mind is that there's an existing kind of narrative of failure around a lot of these developments, right? So you have, you know, failure around urban renewal or highway development or even public housing. And it's important to think about what the intentions of many of these programs were. So from the very beginning, Liberty Square, for instance, was supposed to be a place that was going to elevate African Americans from the working class into the middle class. Public housing was never meant for the poorest of poor. And so Athalie Range, in fact, was one of the first people to live in Liberty Square housing project. And she eventually, you know, bought a suburban home in Brownsville and Liberty City. But these kinds of developments are part of what I call Jim Crow liberalism in the book, where you're recognizing the need for new infrastructure, the need for new roads, the need for new public housing, but it's going to be built on a segregated basis. So Liberty Square was an all-black project, and there were other projects that were meant for all whites. And there's a sense that if you work through the government and you primarily deal with landlords who are going to offer pragmatic mainstream solutions, that you can basically build a real equal into the separate but equal racial order. And so Liberty Square becomes part of this. But what ends up also happening is that as the post-war period continues, and you have 1946 and 47, and there's a sense that Miami's population in particular is going to grow dramatically, probably double in 10 years, the local white officials and planners in downtown say, okay, the best way we're going to solve this problem is by ramping up the state's authority to actually take real estate, to expropriate land. And they begin a pretty concerted effort to actually move against black residential communities. And so you see, for instance, a displacement at a neighborhood called Railroad Shops Colored Edition, which suffers a very dramatic expulsion in a rainstorm in 1947. Some homeowners are having their houses physically lifted out of the ground and moved 15 miles away, only to see them demolished by a hurricane a month later. And so there's a sense that, you know, the post-war period requires ever stronger state powers to basically make sure the color line remains in place. And so I think the urban redevelopment story, as much as we tell the story about the highway, actually begins in the 30s and 40s around these early efforts to make sure that segregation did in fact remain part of the original design, not simply was a kind of corollary to an otherwise noble endeavor.
You talked about that the city would stop garbage pickup at black homes and rental property, and then condemn them because they were unkempt.
That's right. There's an account in the book of the Coleman family, Fred and Annie Coleman, who are trying to move into a new neighborhood, and they're in fact being encouraged by a white real estate speculator to basically, you know, what they call blockbust. Now, there's a story about blockbusting that basically suggests that black buyers are kind of foisted onto white communities, and then those developers who are speculating simply abandon the buyers to whatever kind of hardship that are there. But in this case, a man by the name of Wesley Garrison, who was a real estate developer, was actually advocating for the tearing down of the color line in this area called Brownsville, which eventually became all black, as you probably know. So the Coleman family was able to build a case with the help of Garrison, a white Republican real estate speculator, a man by the name of Luther Brooks, who's a Southern Democrat, also white, who actually takes a really kind of prominent role in the story for the second half, and a number of black Republicans who are also, you know, very much seeing themselves as part of the party of Lincoln to fight for the rights of these homeowners to not have to worry about, you know, whites using trash collection or other forms of violence against them or police power against them. So the fact that you have these homeowners associations that develop and they try to lean on early black buyers as much as they can, it actually prompts among African Americans for them to form their own homeowners associations. And so you begin to see black homeowners groups that emerge in Brownsville and elsewhere to begin to have some kind of control over the local guidelines for trash collection, for levying taxes and the like. And this becomes a really important kind of preceding moment to the much more formal activism that we associate with the civil rights movement in terms of the push for civil rights and voting rights. I argue that property rights is actually the earliest kind of component of black efforts for equality. And you see this in the homeowners associations for sure.
We're speaking with history professor at Johns Hopkins University, Nathan Conley, about his book, A World More Concrete. We'll take another short break and we'll return. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman visiting with history professor Nathan Conley, or NDB Conley, PhD. He's written A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. If you do want to join in the conversation, if you either have memories from that time or want to hear more about it, call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Nathan, you write that between the 1890s and 1960s, people built a sturdy and supple infrastructure for white supremacy that remains very much in place, and I guess you mean today. Would you explain that?
So if we think about the origins of segregation and what it required to control the movement of populations, we tend to think about some of the most dramatic iconography of American apartheid. When we hear the word Jim Crow, we think of the colored-only signs or, you know, the whites-only beaches or bathrooms. But there was a larger kind of infrastructure that was necessary that tried to prevent there from being racial violence. I mean, those signs, for instance, were only in those places where people believed that strangers would congress, right? And there would be some kind of confusion about who belonged to whom. The same mm-hmm. can be said of the roads and bridges and the neighborhoods that were designed to try to prevent there from being racial conflict. You know, Miami is like I mentioned earlier, a remote environment. And there are many boosters who recognize that a city like Birmingham that has an industrial base can suffer certain kinds of violence, and the plants keep churning out steel. In Miami, if you have bloodshed in the streets, they recognize that entire tourist seasons will dry up. And so, you know, for instance, in 1951, there's a bombing at a black housing project, and all you get are these deluge of letters going into the governor's office saying how people are not going to be vacationing in Miami with the threat of racial terrorism there. And so segregation functioned on several different levels. And when the Jim Crow signs officially came down, so many of the roads and bridges and housing projects held those color lines and did a lot of the same work that was asked of them in the era of formal apartheid. And so if you look even now at the way that South Florida has developed, the growth of the populations, be they Hispanic, be they African-American or West Indian or, you know, black America's descent, or the whites who live primarily on Miami Beach or in Coral Gables or in those kinds of communities, Brickell, those color lines follow the old Jim Crow plans. And it's not an accident, right? The fact that you have the East Coast Railroad that served as the default color line in 1896, and that's still largely the boundary between many of these populations today. Or the fact that when the black populations began growing, they grew in a north-south axis. They went from Overtown up into the suburbs just outside and all the way up into Broward County, where I was raised, into Miramar, which is a largely African-American suburb now. It experienced white flight just like so many other communities only decades earlier. And so I think it's really important for us to think through the way that populations are kind of funneled in particular directions. I mean, again, Miami is a place that loves to celebrate its diversity in terms of, you know, its cuisine and the cultural scene and its linguistic diversity. And there are two things with this, which is one, the Jim Crow era was extraordinarily diverse as well. You had school publications, yearbooks written in the black side of town in the high schools that were published in three languages in the 1930s and 40s. So diversity alone is not what makes an area multicultural, right? I think it's also kind of important to bear in mind that with all of Miami's diversity, you can know exactly what kind of neighborhood you're in by simply looking around at the quality of the buildings or, you know, the language of the signs even. And I think that's really important for us to think about decoding that infrastructure and the land that's still there.
What do you mean the signs? I'm sorry.
In terms of colored-only signs, but in terms of billboards in foreign languages. So Haitian Creole, right, in Little Haiti, and
right,
Spanish
right.
in Little Havana. Right.
Okay.
Well, speaking of diversity, I guess it's sort of typical that both Bonnie and I, during this interview, we haven't touched on the exploitation of area Seminoles. Tell us more about that, and also tell the story. Is it Tony Tommy or Tommy Tony in Hialeah?
Hialeah. So Tony Tommy is one of the most fascinating characters I encountered in my research. His name was Hathwahachi, and he gave himself a kind of Anglo name so that many of the business people could, you know, deal with him directly. And he was a very savvy businessman, essentially. I mean, he did not start his elementary education until the age of 14. He was completing about two grades a year. And eventually he recognized that the way of life that most Seminoles had used to sustain them through the late 19th and early 20th century was disappearing, right? Drainage projects had basically carved away at many of the wetlands that Seminoles had used to use their fur, to keep the fur economy going that they were sustaining. Tourism became a really important piece of Miami's new businesses and its infrastructure. And so Tony Tommy began by making sure that Seminoles had a hand to play in Miami's early tourism. You see, for instance, Native Americans on the golf course working as caddies and providing a certain kind of frontier aesthetic for travelers coming down. He actually worked with D.W. Griffith, the famed director of Birth of a Nation, in a film called The Idol Dancer, where he used Seminoles to basically play Polynesian natives in that Griffith picture.
That was in Hialeah also.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, the Hialeah ceremony in particular is one that I spent a little bit of time detailing, because in 1927, after the large hurricane of 1926, and it seems as if Miami's economy has absolutely gone to pot, you have Tony Tommy, who basically decides that in order to give Native Americans access to what he called taxpayer rights, and that's totally key there, the rights of taxpayers to have access to public schools and certain kinds of services, public health, even vaccines, he was going to turn over 150,000 acres of Seminole land. And he engages in this elaborate display with the head of the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce, a man named Lonworth Crow. And he finds a headdress that's been collected by a local Indian dealer from the Plains Indian tribes. And he has a peace pipe from the Iroquois nations in the Northeast. And he has his people carving totem poles from the Northwest tribes in the continental U.S. And so it's this total kind of mishmash of Native American symbolism. And during this ceremony, he goes out into the marsh, the Everglades, and has Native American women dig holes in the ground, followed by men who are planting seeds behind them. Behind those natives come a row of tractors that tear up all of the soil that had just been planted, followed by 13 white women reflecting the nation who plant new seed in the earth. And Tony Tommy, in his native Miccosukee, even though he speaks fluent English, says that the white man is a child of destiny and the red man is a child of nature, and it's time for the child of nature to surrender to the child of destiny. And then he takes off the headdress and puts it on the head of the Miami Chamber of Commerce. They smoke a peace pipe, and this land transaction is officially consecrated, right? And what's so fascinating is not just the display that happens in Hialeah and that people are, you know, going to and paying admission to go see, but that the land itself then moves into the hands of local business people, and one of them being Ernest Graham, who eventually is the father of Bob Graham, the eventual governor of Florida. And so the land that was handed over in the 1920s actually helped to prop up Philip Graham, who became the editor of the Washington Post, William Graham, who became the developer of Miami Lakes, which is obviously, you know, still a very prominent neighborhood in the region, and then Bob Graham's own kind of political fortunes, also propped up by the family dairy farm that was built on that Native American land.
Well, I suppose James Bright would have been included in that, too, with the development of Hialeah and Opa-locka and...
Well, absolutely. I mean, there are a number of developers who were given these small pieces after the main sugar operation that they hoped would take over basically fell through. And so Pensuco. Ernest was one of a number. That's right, Pensuco. Correct.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, or email, that's radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org. How were the color lines negotiated, say, in the 20s and 30s?
You had a series of backdoor conversations that oftentimes happened between black landlords and their white counterparts to try to establish which neighborhoods would be available. Again, oftentimes there were very clear lines in terms of that. But there also were kind of open lines of communication trying to make sure that you could navigate the development of, you know, Miami in relation to the growing population. One of the things that became really instrumental, in fact, was the development of this argument about taxpayer rights. So you have many black property owners who, because they pay property taxes, are able to initiate moments of contestation of the color line and present their tax receipts to the arresting officer and say, I, in fact, deserve to have access to this infrastructure. I want you to build a colored-only, you know, beach in order for us to have a right to swim because we've paid for beachfront access and we don't have any. So the establishment of Virginia Key Beach in the 1940s becomes part of this ongoing question about black taxpayer rights. You also see white employers who are very attentive to the needs of their black employees and who will sometimes, you know, when it gets late at night, will try to move them, shuttle them across the color line so that they don't run into vigilantes who might be trying to, you know, enforce a very strict kind of racial boundary. And so whites play a very important role. The most important figure in my story, in fact, is a man by the name of Luther Brooks, who is a property manager who is immensely popular with African Americans in part because he helps to lessen some of the indignities of segregation. Again, he's kind of like Athalie Range in the sense of he's deeply implicated in some of the worst kind of housing conditions because he basically is the guy who manages the properties for absentee landlords. But he also uses a lot of his income to build a black-only hospital. He's on the board. He has a black radio show for helping African Americans and West Indians register to vote. And so he becomes a kind of power broker between the white political players in the state capitol and some of the local elites who are trying to make sure, again, that the racial peace is kept intact. And so the short answer to your question is that there are a variety of power brokers who essentially operate to try to smooth out some of the tensions in terms of the day-to-day operations of segregation.
We're speaking with Johns Hopkins University history professor Nathan Connolly about his book, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. One last break and we'll return.
In Miami-Dade, there are almost 4,000 children in foster care. Many abused and neglected children go to court alone with no one there to be their voice. You can change that by becoming a guardian ad litem volunteer. Details at weareguardians.org.
Welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and history professor Nathan Connolly. We're talking about his book, A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. Professor, you argued that civil rights activism changed how capitalism worked without unmaking segregation itself. What do you mean by that?
At the outset of early direct action campaigns in the 1950s, sit-ins and other kinds of desegregation efforts, it was clear that part of that effort was being driven by African Americans with resources who wanted to have access to country clubs, wanted to have access to tourist amenities, wanted to have access to a variety of consumer rights, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so in Miami, again, an economy built around tourism, one of the first places where you see desegregation happen is in the hotels. Actually, before the Brown decision in the early 1950s, 52 and 53, you begin to see efforts to push down the color bar and allow blacks to have, you know, conventions on Miami Beach and the like. And so there's an early notion that the best way to create opportunities is to have the best of black America have access to that to which their money entitles them, right? So there's a very clear sense that if you open up consumer rights, that civil rights will be, you know, not long behind. And this ends up being a very, I think, fateful miscalculation, because what ends up happening is that obviously you have a number of, you know, white entrepreneurs and investors who recognize the value of black buying power, or even early suburban communities that say, okay, we want to open up new neighborhoods for black suburban buyers, but it then creates these concentrations of black poverty that lead to other kinds of problems. So if you think about the way the Jim Crow structure functioned in the early part of the 20th century, where black dentists and doctors were living alongside farmers and domestics. Again, there might have been class tensions there, but the geography of segregation meant that they had to live together. When you make consumer rights the kind of focus of the development of sit-ins and other kinds of civil rights activism, it actually tries to create a wedge between the black poor and the black elite, or the upwardly mobile. And this leads to a whole host of other problems, which ends up being the concentration of poverty in Overtown. You have then these populations being forcibly imposed back onto black middle class and suburban homeowners through public housing projects, which creates new kinds of tensions. One of the biggest conflicts in the book is actually among the homeowners of Brownsville, who are fighting against the imposition of the black poor back onto their neighborhoods by local planners, who think that there's no place else where the poor black in the city can go but back into the black suburbs. And so you see then the downward mobility of Brownsville and Liberty City, and there ends up being a riot in 1968 in Liberty City, a neighborhood that was considered to be a landscape of great promise in the 1950s, is now being surrounded by police barricades, has, you know, burning stores and more kind of dense and impoverished populations. And so I think there was a way that the language of full equality ended up being somewhat truncated in the earlier part of the 20th century because landlords were dictating the agenda. They were the property owners who were going with their property tax receipts, for instance. And if there had been a slightly more robust discussion about the rights of tenants and to build kind of tenant organizing as one place of politics among many, it would have been a probably more successful overall effort to try to take down some of the economic foundations that held segregation in place.
Professor, in the last segment, we were talking about the development in Hialeah and Miami Springs and such, and I mentioned Glenn Curtis. Of course, his partner was the aviation hero, Glenn Curtis. We mentioned James Bright. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. We have a caller here. He wants to know if Broward County was more liberal or conservative as far as race and real estate.
Not at all. Not at all. You know, there are some. I actually.
It was more conservative.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, the way that the day-to-day political operation of segregation worked, again, with these kind of intermediaries, totally dictated the humanity or the lack thereof in one county or another. So someone like Luther Brooks, who was very prominent in Dade County, did not have that much of a presence in Broward County. And so the rental conditions were actually worse in Fort Lauderdale than they were in Miami, if you can believe it, in the mid part of the 20th century. Dania, again, in Broward, had a very clear racial curfew, just like Miami Beach did. And there are stories. Kitty Oliver, for instance, has a great oral history collection that's at the Sistrunk African American Museum there that details what the experience was of blacks living in Dania in Hollywood in Broward County. And again, very clear examples of threats of racial terrorism, you know, ideas around, you know, where blacks were supposed to be after dark. All of that is happening in Broward as well as in Dade. The thing that makes Broward kind of interesting is Broward becomes the site where many whites travel when they're fleeing the influx of Cubans and the growth of the black population in the 1960s and 70s, right? So there's a sense that's the kind of, you know, white promised land out of Dade County when these populations begin to change. But of course, the same kinds of processes then occur where segregation gets more dense as the population grows. You have also kinds of displacement. There's a neighborhood just outside of Dania, for instance, that gets taken, you know, for the sake of expanding the white community. So you have the same kinds of dynamics, but the narratives that we now associate with Overtown or with the development of Liberty City are not nearly as developed for Broward County as they are for Dade. So it might be easy to think that there might not be as much conservative racial politics there, but it's clear that those two counties are very much of a pair.
I'd like you to talk now, before we run out of time, about that ribbon cutting ceremony in 1969 for that park, the first, America's first under expressway park, which was so poignant the way you talked about it because of it being the land of sun and how there they are with the jungle gyms and the stuff under, you know, an expressway and all the fumes from the cars, and 12,000 residents had been displaced in order to build that expressway. So talk about that.
So I'm from South Florida. I grew up, as I mentioned, in Broward County. And so when I first saw that image as a researcher and a graduate student, I said, oh, this is a great idea. It makes perfect sense. You can never go outside during the heat of the day anyway, right? So the shade must be really great. But then as I began to ask more questions about it and figure out where the park came from, it became a very important monument to the culture of negotiation between black and white elites. Again, Athalie Range, who we talked about earlier, is the person who helped to create the park. The park is actually named after her. And it came through a coalition between members of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the mayor's office, the city council, city commission, I should say, and a variety of private donors as well, who all kind of pulled this together to create this ceremony. Now, the building of the park was supposed to be a kind of community balm after the riots of Liberty City. This was supposed to be a moment of healing and, real kind of coalition building. But, it was also a park that quickly fell into disrepair. I mean, you can see in the images from the book that, the grass was never really kept very well. And FPNL, who was supposed to donate lights to the park so that you could use it at night, never came through. And So there's a variety of ways in which the park itself became this kind of image of the false promises of these interracial coalitions among elites. After a while, it becomes very clear that many of those same children who in 1968 are asked to go under Expressway Park are going to be the folks who take to the streets in 1980 with the Arthur McDuffie riots, right? So there's It's a very strange continuity from one era to the next, where as you underserve one generation, it's only prone to come back in a different form and with great discontent later on.
Nathan Connolly, tell us a little more about you and also your South Florida connection.
And the changes in South Florida since you left.
Oh, wow. So I was born in Connecticut, but moved to Florida as a young child, 7 years old. And I grew up in Miramar, in fact, went to Perry Middle and eventually went to Nova High School. And I went to college in South Florida as well, St. Thomas University. My neighborhood was one of several working class suburbs that basically made this transition from white to black while I was there. I'm actually writing another book project about the 1990s and 2000s development of Broward and Dade County, but through the perspective of my family. It's a very early stage right now, but there's something about these neighborhoods that the minute that Haitians or Jamaicans seem to show up, a lot of my white friends basically left town, or their parents left town, right? And so the same kinds of fears, and I remember many of the accounts and the kinds of rumors that would be bandied about, where they would say, oh, the ducks are disappearing from the neighborhood. It must mean that the Haitians are in town, right? I mean, these very kind of pejorative notions of the populations kind of changing the character of the neighborhood. And so, when I grew up in South Florida, there was a part of me that absolutely hated it as an adolescent. It was too hot. I couldn't get around without a car. The seasons never changed. And then when I went off to graduate school and was trying to think about, interesting research sites, all the things that I didn't like about South Florida became extraordinarily interesting from an intellectual standpoint, right? Why is it, in fact, that there's such dispersed populations in Miami? Why is it that tourism seems to still carry the day? Why is it that there are these narratives about neighborhoods going downhill when certain populations move in? And that began to inspire me to raise some of these questions and ultimately to go back to the source of the region and to explore these questions.
We've just about run out of time. We want to thank you, Nathan Connolly. It's been a most interesting hour. We certainly want to thank you, Nathan Connolly of Johns Hopkins University. And his book is A World More Concrete, Real Estate and the Remaking of Jim Crow South Florida. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
And thanks for tuning in this hour, a little history. We might have some of those on our history quiz. Our producer, Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary, free program audio archives at our website, that's WLRN.org, and more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page, courtesy Paul Leary. Tomorrow's program is with whistleblower and now author George Mallinckrodt, a former Florida Department of Corrections therapist. He was fired and has written the book Getting Away with Murder. Also, Miami Herald reporter Julie Brown has covered the story. And Bonnie, let's have a calendar today. On this day in 1886, 128 years ago, the Statue of Liberty is dedicated in New York Harbor, a gift from the people of France, including its pedestal. It's 305 feet high, commemorates the U.S. Declaration of Independence. And on this day in 1919, 95 years ago, the Volstead Act is passed by Congress over the veto of President Wilson. America was dry. One more. On this day in 1965, 49 years ago, the positioning of its 4-foot keystone completes the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. 630 feet high and built of stainless steel, the engineering tolerance of each leg was 1/64 of an inch. Otherwise, the legs wouldn't meet. Big trouble. So we leave with a thought from humorist Will Rogers about prohibition. Quote, "Why don't they pass a constitutional amendment prohibiting anybody from learning anything? If it works as well as prohibition did, in 5 years, Americans would be the smartest people on earth." Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.